Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to welcome Senator David Durenberger from Minnesota, three-term senator in the 80s and 90s, to speak about his book, When Republicans Were Progressive. It's really great to have you here. Great book and a really, really good background on a period of time. I think that is fascinating to a lot of us. And it gives such a different angle on the problems of today and how the similar problems were dealt with before. I think it's a great analysis of that and helpful because we still have the same problem. So what I'd like to start with is a little bit about Harold Stassen. You know, a lot of people who remember Harold Stassen remember him as the guy who kept running for president until he was 85. Now, at the time, running for president when you were 85 years old seemed, you know, a little bit, you know, like 20 years too much. Now it's only 5 years too much.
Very good.
So Harold might not have gotten the same reputation that he got back then, but your story gives the great background on Harold. He was a 31-year-old wunderkind in Minnesota politics and a very influential person. I'm going to go into a little bit about that, but just give us a little bit of his backstory, please.
Sure. But if I may, I'd like to introduce my wife.
Absolutely.
Susan B. Foote. Born up in Pacific Heights, educated in the city, went off to school on the East Coast, came back, worked at on the business school. She was a member of the, didn't work at, she was a member of the faculty at Berkeley, at the business school at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Came to Washington, fell in love with the former, well, fell in love with the senator, I guess. And we're now living happily ever after with six children, 14 grandchildren, a home in St. Paul for about 8 months out of the year and 4 months here in Marin and San in San Rafael, but she's currently famous in Minnesota because she has just recently won the Minnesota Book Awards for History with a book called Crusade for Forgotten Souls, which is the really interesting, intimate story of how Minnesota became the leader in mental health reform and disability reform way back in 1949, 50, 51, and how it was possible then, a little bit about how we lost it. But the real story is how did we do it in Minnesota? So that's, I'm proud of my wife, Susan.
We will get a question about that. That's a very interesting issue in San Francisco today. So I think if anyone has a question for her later in Q&A, we'll get up here to answer it.
Okay, so Harold Stassen. Harold Stassen was a farmer's son from Dakota County, graduated the University of Minnesota Law School when he was 23 years old, formed a law firm in South St. Paul with a Democrat who, within a couple of years, got himself elected to Congress from St. Paul, the old 4th district. Harold was elected the Dakota County attorney. He was elected president of the South St. Paul JCs, all of whom decided at about the time Harold was 30 that he ought to be governor of Minnesota. And so his friends, with Stassen in the lead, rode their horses through 100 Minnesota towns, and he ended up winning the governorship at age 31 in 1938 by the largest vote margin in the history of the state. How did he do it? It's the depths of the Great Depression. The now famous Democratic president is trying to rescue millions of people from the Depression. And Stassen demonstrates what it means to be a progressive Republican. He praises Roosevelt for his efforts. He criticizes Democrats in Minnesota for corruption in state government, in a state which, like its famous son, Charles Lindbergh, is opposed to going to war with Nazi Germany in 1938. But he disagrees. He's a strong supporter of taking the fight to Adolf Hitler. He was in instant demand as a national speaker after he was elected at 31. And it was said the Republicans would run him for vice president in 1940 if they could, but he was too young. That's what he meant on the national scene. Harold Stassen, to me, and for us tonight, was the Mayor Pete Buttigieg of his time. And I just want you to leave with that thought in mind, because there's always a time, and whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, there's a time for leadership of another kind. Stastny was reelected twice, resigned his office to take a commission in the U.S. Navy. He stood with Admiral Halsey on the deck of the ship to accept the surrender of Emperor Hirohito of Japan in 1945. Before that, he worked tirelessly on developing the League of Nations Charter, and he ended up, before he died, being the last surviving, with one exception, an Algerian signer of the Declaration of Independence. He decided to run for the presidential nomination of the Republican Party, lost to Governor Tom Dewey, who lost to Harry Truman, and Stassen became president of the University of Pennsylvania, prepared to run again in 1952. But so did Dwight D. Eisenhower, decided he would run. So Eisenhower became his employer and was unhelpful to Stassen in his efforts to tame Secretary of State John Foster Dulles and his brother Alan Dulles. And those whose sole mission for America was to turn every other nation's effort at independence from colonial rule into a war against the Soviet spread of godless communism. Why do we remember Stassen as the quadrennial candidate for president? Because he believed that each time he ran, his opponents learned from his policy ideas, even when he was 85. And the winner used them to change public policy. And secondly, because by the mid-1950s, this progressive Republican looked at the leadership that had replaced him in Minnesota and found young men and women, another generation of men and women who thought like he did in the 1950s. They belonged to the Citizens League and organizations like that. They were encouraged by employers like the Dayton Hudson people to get active. And he said to himself, and he told me, they don't need me in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. They don't need me in Minnesota. That was Harold Stassen.
Mm-hmm. There's two points there that you mentioned briefly. One I want you to tell a little bit more about. One is how many politicians who were governor of a state resigned as governor in order to join the military during World War II. That's not too common. But the other one was you just said, that he and his friends rode into 100 towns on their horses. This was literal. I think you should explain how literal it was that they rode into town on their horses.
Yeah. South St. Paul, where he came from, was the cow capital of Minnesota, or actually the cow capital of the upper Midwest, because it was the biggest slaughterhouse, if you will, cattle slaughterhouse between Omaha, Nebraska, and Chicago. And so part of farming and part of hustling cattle and part of the process was learning how to ride a horse. And so it was great growing up on the farm. And so we called ourselves in South St. Paul, even when I joined his firm later on, mm-hmm. we called ourselves the Hook'em Cows. Asked me to try to explain that. I don't know. But we called ourselves the Hook'em Cows. And the Hook'em Cows are the guys who got on the horses and rode through all these little towns. And nobody had ever done that before to introduce one of their number, a 30-year-old, as the next governor.
It's really a great story. And he had a very productive career his whole life. But he, you know, when he resigned after 2 years, two terms as governor to join the Navy, he was still, 30-something years old, like 38, 39 years old, something like that. Yeah. So it's good to remember that almost everybody who has a backstory who who you see in a particular fashion in their octogenarian years, put it that way. Another thing about Harold, I think, is that he's probably a quintessential member of the old boys club, what people would now call the old boys club. And one of the things that you talk about is the corporations, the corporate leaders, the other members of this Republican middle ground, and what their strategy was. And for the corporations, I think you worked for Hooper, Cooper or Hooper? K.E. Hooper, that you worked for a corporation for a while after.
H.B. Fuller.
H.B. Fuller, yeah. And you said that the leader said that his approach to his corporation was that you put your service to your customers first, to your employees second, to your shareholders third, and to your community fourth. And I was wondering if when, you know, the old boys club got kicked out, whether we threw out that idea with the bathwater, you know, that there was something that was lost in this. I mean, I think it definitely was a good idea that we've moved beyond the boys club, but that this idea was part of the paternalism. It was a different thing. And my hometown was that way too, that the leaders, for example, would make 20 or 25 times what their employees would make, but they didn't make hundreds of times. And their emotional satisfaction was that they were leaders in the community and they were a little looked at as the fathers of the community. That was the name that was used for them. And I was just wondering what you think about the shift from that old boys club to today and what was lost and what was gained.
Yeah, I'm going to be brief in my response and recognize first that your father was a progressive mayor of Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And one of the most famous companies in Kenosha, Wisconsin was American Motors.
Right.
And the head of American Motors was George Romney.
Right.
I love George Romney.
Well, you're looking at his namesake because I was named after George Romney.
That's right.
Where I got my name George from.
Yeah. And George Romney would have been mystified at what his son did, you know, when he ran for president and disowned a substantial contribution that they made to health care policy in the state of Massachusetts, in effect. George Romney, for some reason or other, liked me and invited me to be part of the National Center for Voluntary Action. We remained friends until the day he died.
Mm-hmm.
He was just such an outgoing, giving person. That's what's missing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's missing. We've depersonalized, whether it's the Dayton Hudson Corporation, now Target versus something or other, or it's one of our favorite automobile companies, or it's God knows what else. We've depersonalized the corporate entity. Elmer Anderson used to say to me when I worked there, he said, the only reason I went public is so that my employees with the stock market, with the company, because I thought I could do it better as a private company, but I went there because my employees could benefit from the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did. So that's a noble way to think about the corporate enterprise, but it makes your point about then, and I won't even try to make the point about now.
Yeah,
because you struggle with that kind of an ethic. Mm-hmm. You're going to struggle today in a market in which, you know, tech runs everything, and then comes finance, and then comes healthcare, and they're all three out of control, but somebody sees that as the American future.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues that you've worked on your whole life, and healthcare is one of them. I mean, you were involved in the first creation of HMOs. You were involved in, I think, the writing of the COBRA legislation that allowed people to hold on to. Anybody use COBRA sometime in their life? Okay. This is one of the men that made that happen for you. So you've been involved in this your whole life, and we can't go over all those details. So some of them are in the book, but what I'm interested in is, what do you think of the idea of Medicare for all that is being presented now as one of the options?
I don't understand why a number of Democratic candidates for president of the United States who are in the United States Senate, some of whom were in the United States Senate when President Obama bit the bullet on March 4th of 2009, said to 150 representatives of 150 of the healthcare's biggest special interest groups, if you help me get it done, we're going to reform the healthcare system in this country so you have you make a meaningful contribution to the future of healthcare.
Mm.
The House, the Democratic House, went ahead, passed a bill.
Mm.
And within a matter of just a couple of weeks, the majority leader, of the Republican leader of the Senate, declared President Obama to be a one-term president, turned August into a town hall meeting that people will never forget, never forget. Where, and I did town hall meetings for some Congress members, and half the room, 700 people were in Mankato High School, 500 people in a high school in Rochester, Minnesota. And you could see right down the middle, everybody on this side was fed the garbage by the right-wing media and their the right-wing think tank sources. What's wrong with Obamacare already? You know? And so there's 1,350 people over there. And over here are the others. Mm-hmm. And these poor senators are standing up there taking that heat. And it was happening all over America. So here we are today. The Republicans pulled out. They pretended to stay in the Senate Finance Committee until December, mm-hmm. behind the scenes. But they pulled out of what would have been a bipartisan effort in my time, into 16 years, and most of those as chairman of the Health Subcommittee, mm-hmm. in two committees. It would have been the kind of health care system that everybody in this room could stand up and applaud for today, then, or mm-hmm. or today. But when the Republicans pulled out, they pulled out Chuck Grassley. They pulled out John McCain. They pulled out people who were my colleagues in the Senate who understood what it takes to get to, you mm-hmm. know, real health policy reform, which is not the political way. Mm-hmm. And their chains were all jerked. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know why the Democratic candidates now, including our senator from Minnesota, don't say to the question, what are you going to do about health care? Say, finish doing Obamacare. Mm-hmm. Get it right. Mm-hmm. Get it right. It's something Democrats and Republicans who are then knowledgeable could agree on. Let's get it done right. Excuse me.
No, it's great. You mentioned, it was a totally different topic, but you mentioned that you saw on an issue how public policy, the issue itself, was trumped by partisan politics early on in Minnesota. It was the first time you had seen that, and I believe it was just after you had worked for the governor of Minnesota. It was an abortion, maybe, or something like that, that there was something that happened that showed people switching sides or switching sides. Maybe it was in the sales tax, that they switched sides. They agreed with the policy issue, but then they realized for partisan politics purposes they were going to have to just not do that, say the exact opposite of what they thought.
Tell you what I wrote about, because I came in with Harold Evander when he was elected governor in 1966. Mm. And we had a 2/3 majority of conservatives, as they were called, in the mm. House, and almost a 2/3 majority of conservatives in the Senate, as they were called. But when the leadership asked the new governor what he wanted them to do in 1967, he said, pass the Republican Party platform. Mm-hmm. And the St. Paul Pioneer Press said in May, mm-hmm. Republicans passed nearly 2/3 of the Republican platform into law. What was the Republican platform in 1967? Well, it included the nation's first Department of Human Rights, mm-hmm. a pollution control agency, a Department of Labor and Industry. You know, it created the Metropolitan Council and the Metropolitan Sewage Commission, and it created a policy environment in higher education and in government that could anticipate the problems that economic development and population change was going to have mm-hmm. in the state of Minnesota. Now, how can that happen? How did that come from Republicans? Mm-hmm. Be at the grassroots. At the precinct caucus. People went to precinct caucuses and they passed resolutions on issues just like I talked to you about. Then they went to the county level, then to the district level, then to the state level, and then they went to the legislature and became law. Today what happens, okay, the first resolution is get rid of Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. There used to be other people who came to these meetings. They don't come anymore because they know the first resolution is going to be Roe v. Wade, and Roe v. Wade will sit there. That group will sit there the rest of the time. This started with Gordon Rosemeyer, probably the genius of the – didn't start with – it started with him because he allowed a more liberal or progressive Republican senator to have a hearing on a bill related to abortion.
Only a hearing.
Yep, only a hearing.
Yeah.
And a young lawyer from his town in Little Falls, Minnesota, ran against him on that issue, said Gordon Rosemeyer, who did more than any legislator's ever done to help the legislative process anticipate the needs of a state that is growing mm-hmm. in the 60s and in the 70s. And the young lawyer saw his advantage, ran against him on that issue, and won.
Yeah. I think for context, it's really useful to see – what was the hearing on abortion? It was in 67. It was 6 years before Roe v. Wade, if I've got the year right. And the hearing was for a bill that would allow abortion in the cases of rape or incest or if the mother was going to, her health was at stake. Those three issues, That was the only thing to be accepted. And that was what the other guy ran against and kicked this guy out after 30 years of his career. And the guy who got kicked out was a Republican, and the guy who kicked him out on the issue was a Democrat. Mm-hmm. I find that very interesting,
yeah.
You know, because, this is not the way the issue comes. And I think, your book is full of those examples of you have a 60-year career in politics, in local politics, and then national politics, international politics. And so many of the issues are exactly the same, with parties reversed and all kinds of things different. And, you know, you just find that we like to argue about things.
Yeah.
We just keep arguing about things. So another thing that you worked on is climate, clean environment. Yeah. You said one of the things, I think you said, that the platform, I think of maybe Lyle Schwarzkopf, the way he stated it, was the Republican progressive platform was decent safety net, good roads, good schools, clean environment, and make government effective. I think those are the things. Now, sounds not like a Republican platform at all today, but let's talk about the clean environment. And my question basically is, because you worked, I believe, on committees that had dealt with the ozone hole, which people will remember got fixed more or less, or at least something really was done about it, and also on acid rain. And I was wondering, the way that it's being presented today as climate change and people are, you know, afraid that the whole planet is going to fall apart, do you think that that's a better method of scaring people into doing something? Or do you think trying to clean up the environment, you know, just having a clean environment, clean water, clean, was a more effective means of moving forward?
The problem today is the failure of Republicans to acknowledge there's even a problem.
Yeah.
And so you can just take that and you can adapt it,
yeah,
to any tactic, any technique, whatever it is. And so the frustration of a Democrat or a progressive Republican in dealing with environmental issues is they won't even acknowledge the existence of a problem, mm-hmm, to say nothing of what science may say, mm-hmm, causes it. So private sector has to get out in front of it. And in a state like Minnesota, because we have a power company like now called NSP, for those of you who've been from the state, now called Xcel Energy,
mm-hmm,
has made a commitment to get rid of, you know, all the pollutant, the appropriate pollutants by 2050 and half of them by 2030 and things like that. So that's all we're left with on a state-by-state basis. When I left the Senate in 1995, there was one avowed anti-climate Republican. That was Jim Inhofe,
mm-hmm,
from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Today, it's like Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
Every Republican's got to say no to anything that has to do with these issues. But in a reasonable time, in which I believe that I operated in the Senate in the 80s in particular, and into the early 90s, it was both Republican and Democratic leadership that acknowledged the necessity of starting as early as possible with the smallest steps possible, mm-hmm, in order to take on these really big issues.
Mm-hmm.
And science had a big role to play in it. So did politics. When I did acid rain, for example, I did that with Prime Minister Peterson of Canada,
mm-hmm,
because acid rain was being generated in Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, and so forth through coal emissions, and it was the prevailing wind was taking it up into Canada, and so the Canadians had a big stake in it, and we came up with carbon trading.
Mm-hmm.
No, let's make a business out of this. Let's put a price on it,
mm-hmm,
and let's let some power companies benefit, you know, at the expense of the cost of taking it down. There was and we all came to California,
mm-hmm,
to make the California point, because California has always been ahead. So every time I had a challenge, we did the Clean Air Act, mm-hmm, in 1990,
mm-hmm,
in addition to other things in 1990. And George Mitchell was the Democratic leader, but he had a Republican president, and he wanted George H.W. Bush's signature on the Clean Air Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked hard to find out, how do you make this air, how do you make the air legislation work? And we came to California. And we found businesses in California that had already started to solve the problem, maybe because California required that, or maybe simply because of the nature of who they were mm-hmm. as businesses. But traditionally, this has been a place where you could see the future mm-hmm. on the solutions to environmental issues. But the neat part of that story when you read the book mm-hmm. is that the Democratic leader of the Senate, with a majority in the Senate and a majority in the House, realized that if a bill went to the House, the more liberal House would put all kinds of provisions in there that the Republican president couldn't handle. So George Mitchell had three of us Republicans and three of our Democratic counterparts in his office every day before our bill went to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had the president's secretary of energy and the president's general counsel and people like that sat with us. And we worked this baby out. Then we went to the floor. We fought off all the amendments, the loosening up amendments and the other amendments on the floor, went to the House, conferred with the House, came back with a bill that our George H.W. Bush could sign. And whether it was Clean Air or it was the American Disabilities Act was like this. Mm-hmm. And I I need to express the most emotional time of my whole life in the mm-hmm. Senate, because I was the Republican author of the ADA, was the day in July of 1990 that President Bush was going to sign the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm.
And when they played Hail to the Chief as he came walking out to the grounds and off on the south side of the White House, half the audience stood up. And the rest of the audience said, "Down in front." If you've worked your butt off, you know, for something as meaningful as that, for people like that, you just sit there and cry when you hear "down in front."
Yeah.
Because you know how much that has meant. And I'll never forget it. And I'm sure a lot of other people won't either.
But. Yeah, and I know that some of that had already started. But if you just think about our childhoods and the curbs everywhere, and it's just these curb entrances for ramps for everything, yeah. It's all everywhere. And yes, it costs lots of money to change, but hasn't it made life more civil? Absolutely. To go back to another little element that you added there about the turn to the right of the Republican Party, you trace the start of this to a decision made at the FCC to take down the Fairness Doctrine, that if the Fairness Doctrine for the radio was taken down so that it wasn't required anymore, that you gave equal time and so on, and that when that was eliminated in the late 80s under Reagan or something by one of his guys at the FCC, that's what gave rise to right-wing radio and that then influenced things over time. I mean, that was one of many strands.
Right.
But it was interesting to see that was an influential bureaucratic decision in the FCC about a fairness doctrine led to the proliferation of this.
Right. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's a fact. There were other factors why, you know, all these characters were out there. And by that time, there was also the think tanks had been bought or created in, there's now 62 of them or 63 of them.
Mm-hmm.
At the state level, and these same people are providing the grist, if you will, for the mill. So,
well, I have one big question for you before we go to the Q&A. But before that, even though I know that you're a policy man, and we've covered quite a few of the policies, and there are more detail in the book. Obviously, you've lived your life in the middle of a tremendous political shift, and you've known so many different characters that were the main players over the years. You mentioned in your book how much you admired King Hussein, I think, of Jordan, as an individual. Maybe if you just tell us about some of the characters that stand out in your mind that you ran into over the years. I know that there's maybe at least a few dozen, but you could pick and choose that.
Yeah, maybe I'll just do a couple. But on the... on the side of who caused the current problems,
You do cover that in your book.
Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. That simple.
Yeah.
It started with him when he came. He brought it with him. He was a radio jock in North Carolina, and that's how he got elected. And what did he do? Beating on the colored, or whatever the case may be. And he brought that. He brought that to the United States Senate. He brought it to international policy, as well as he brought it to, by the way, I use the word colored in quotes as an illustration. I got a squint from my wife. a little messy.
It's really good to have a wife.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's what he did. I had story after story. The only one, which was when Ted Kennedy, whole staff and Ted Kennedy were at a funeral service for one of their staff members who died of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse Helms chose that as the time to put up an anti-AIDS amendment.
Yeah.
And I only know that because I got called wherever I was and said, you got to get to the floor. And you got to defend on that until somebody can come back from the funeral to take this one on. So I'll start with that. You can add Newt Gingrich and Dick Cheney and a bunch of people like that. But it's as poison as you can get with a man who will not acknowledge that he isn't right and has the power to put a lot of other people down in order to get it done because he has the power behind him that we see now under another president.
Mm-hmm.
On the positive side, the first gift was, and I'll do this for Joe Biden. The first gift was being able to choose the position on the Senate Finance Committee as a brand new senator who didn't even know what a senator was, basically, because I had been running for governor and got
It's a great story.
Talked into running for the Senate. But my first choice is a Republican seat on the Senate Finance Committee. And I turned to a guy that I just hired from Ed Brooks' staff, and I said, is that one worth going after? Or should I go for appropriations where they spend all the money? And he said, well, you got to stand for re-election in 4 years, so I'd go after that one, the Finance Committee. So I go after the Finance Committee, and I get a handwritten letter from Russell Long from Louisiana, the chairman of the committee, tracing the relationship of Louisiana and Minnesota going back to 1803, the Louisiana Purchase. So when I get to meet him, I said, what's that all about? And he said, well, President Carter, you know, the prices of gas and oil are going through the roof, so President Carter wants us to put a windfall profits tax on the excess, and so he can give it to poor people for home heating oil and things like that. And all you need to know, young man, is that what my constituents do is produce the stuff, and what yours do is burn it. And he looked at me, watched my face, and he laughed. I love that man. I love that man, Russell Long. He had just gone through treatment for the last time, got a new wife. Sounded like he traded it in, but no. I mean, he had a perfect marriage and a perfect way of reflecting on the end of the life that he had been leading. And he looked at me and he said, you know, here's the good news. There are two of us from every state. The founding fathers needed it that way because every one of these colonies, the colonists were here for a different reason, depending on where they came from. So that's why we have a Senate that has two from each Senate. And so he said, when every state is heard from, we get good national energy policy or tax policy or whatever the case may be. I could go on with, and I'm going to quit it because there's so many people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I picked that in honor of Joe Biden because Joe Biden is getting hell now for working with guys from the South who weren't, you know, not ideal. Mm-hmm. Some of them weren't even close to it, but I picked that in honor of Joe, in honor of a time that is past. But the good things need to follow, like Russell Long's story, need to come forward with that. And so that's why I picked that one. And I could pick lots of others. But in the international travels, which you refer to, and I hope you'll find this interesting in the book, because one of my first overseas trips was, I didn't get to see him the first time. I met him in Washington, D.C. was King Hussein of Jordan. King Hussein of Jordan took office when his father was killed in 1947, when King Hussein was 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he reigned for 50, 60 years before he himself died. But when I met him, he asked me to pray for him. I said, I don't know how to pray in Islam, you know. And and he said, no, you pray in whatever you are, you know, whatever it is. And so I did. And so every time we met, the second last time was in his home in Jordan. The only time I'd ever been over there. We stayed up all night from 1 a.m. when I finally got there after he had been at the hospital with his mother-in-law till 8 o'clock in the morning when I got to go to the Allenby Bridge to get into Israel. I never met a man, and we talked, we prayed, but mainly he couldn't stop talking about how the United States did not appreciate the fact that Jordan was the only of the countries in the Middle East that had no reason not to defend the United States. It had no oil, it had no gas, it had none of this kind of stuff. It was just a country, and it had 70% of Palestinians that used to live, either on the West Bank or in some other area, were now living in Jordan. And he had to deal with that in some way, but he wasn't being adequately recognized. So the role that he played, though, in other things in the book, and there's lots of other people, the two guys that came in and ended the genocides in Rwanda, Paul Kagame, who's still the president of Rwanda, and what's the name? The president of Burundi. And Pierre Buyoya, and we are still friends with Pierre, who's now in Mali, the African Union, and his wife and two of his children who are work for Cummins Engine. And I could go on and on. I was going to stop. Just one last one to illustrate the point of why it's worth reading the book is the time that Tony Hall, a congressman, and I got to visit with Rajiv Gandhi. We were in Delhi, India, but didn't have an appointment. But somehow or other, they got 5 minutes on his agenda before some important meeting. So Tony and I went in to talk to him about, we said, we're here to talk about Jesus. And he said, yeah, I've been told that. And how can I help you talk about Jesus? And I said, well, talk about relationships. Oh, okay. Like love your brother, do unto others as you would have them do unto you and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. He said, well, I guess the best illustration is the relationship that I have with Benazir Bhutto, the prime minister of Pakistan. Half our army is up in Kashmir, and half of her army is up in Kashmir, and it's mountainous. Every time the snow begins to avalanche, they start shooting. And he said, either I call her or she calls me and says, they're at it again. you can't but be touched by leaders who are that frank with somebody they don't really know well because you put it on the basis, there's no political basis to the conversation. Right. You put it on the basis of relationships. Relationships. What are we taught by our faith or whatever the sources of our religions and so forth that teach us? And it's all the same. Basically all the same wherever you go.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Learn about our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for any of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now back to our program.
That's great. Okay, I have one big question for you before we go to the Q&A, and that's, you've done all this work, and it's kind of my impression democracy is an orphan still. I mean, a child, we haven't really done it for very long as a human institution, and we're still learning, if we're even paying attention, that we should be learning. You're in a really good position to have learned something about what works in democracy and what doesn't, and I know that you wrote near the end of your book about ranked voting and other things like that. So, is there some big prescription that you can think of or ideas that you have that you think will help our democratic future or help make the future democratic if we can keep it that way?
Yeah.
What ideas will your bottom line ideas about democracy versus authoritarian government?
Yeah.
Something we didn't think we'd have to talk about.
Yeah. The last chapter of the book starts with ranked choice voting because it's The ranked choice voting simply means you put down your first, second, third, fourth choices for an office. And the purpose of getting ranked, we have it in Minneapolis and it works. And what it does is gets people to stop knocking each other, you know, because that person you're knocking might be not be your opponent, you know, or something like that. Right. But so we start with ranked choice voting. St. Paul has it now too, but we'd like it to cover the whole state. It's to shape up the parties. That's why we do that. Another one is, I think California is already ahead of us on this, is a redistricting commissions. Mm-hmm. The new governor of Minnesota, who happens to be a Democrat, told me last Friday, after that decision came out, that he intends to have appointed, and I think he's trying to figure out how not to have him be the only one that makes the appointments, but he's going to appoint a commission, even though it's not required of him to do that. Mm-hmm. And even though he said it's going to make my Democratic friends, you know, a little upset mm-hmm. by me for doing this, but he said that's at least my present intention mm-hmm. to take on that issue. But the really big ones goes back to one of our first questions here about corporate America mm-hmm. and influence that it has. Is it good or is it not so good? Mm-hmm. And if you compare my time with today and you see the amount of money that is being spent on campaigns and on lobbyists, mm-hmm. you know, 85 or 90 or 100% of whom are former staffers or former members. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to be pretty darn good to go up against that kind of power. Just look at how difficult it's been to knock some sense into the drug, device, and diagnostics industry. Mm-hmm. The only country in the world in which those three industries get away with pricing everything that's new off the charts. Mm-hmm. No other country does that. So just being able to take that one on right now is not something that is easily done, and there's no magic ways of getting it done except from the inside out.
Yeah, there's no more Senator Proxmire's that was right next door who got reelected several, like five times or whatever on a budget of like $1,000 or something like that.
$250.
$250.
Yeah, filing fee. That was it.
Filing fee. That's all he spent. Yeah. He would walk around.
Right.
Anyway, so that's... I that's where we should stop for now, so we can go right to the questions of the audience. So thank you very, very much for coming. And it's time, and I'd like to remind our audience to listen to Senator David Durenberger, formerly from, still from Minnesota, but former senator from Minnesota, speaking about his book, When Republicans Were Progressive. So who would like to ask the first question?
Greetings, and thank you. Do you think we'll ever see a Colin Powell or a Jack Kemp type of Republican in the next, you know, 15 years?
Yes. You made it easy with me when you added 15 years. I wouldn't have spent 3 years writing this book if I didn't believe that there was an antidote to what we do to each other today in community after community and between communities and things like that. The blue angel, red angel, you know, that sort of thing. There's a limit to all of this. And there's no easy way to say when it's gonna change. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Trump got elected again. I hate to say that.
That's right.
I hate to say it, but you know, it's entirely possible. But once he's a quote, you know, there's speculation that he'll find some way to issue an executive order to give him himself a third term. But at some point, even the right wingers on the Supreme Court have to object to that one.
Next question.
Given that you are well-versed in healthcare, it seems to me that our problem isn't access. Our problem is delivery. And you just mentioned at the end of your talk how the lobbyists for the industries rule the roost. But everyone is talking about giving more people access to a system that is completely dysfunctional mm-hmm. because it's ruled by the people who make a profit on people's health. do you see any way of changing the conversation to address delivery rather than access?
Thank you. And that's a good point you make about delivery, because delivery to some people, like orthopedic surgeons or something like that, you know, who make decisions about should you have surgery or should you have physical therapy. And if they choose surgery, they make a lot more money, you know, than the alternative, assuming it can go either way. That's one thing. But if you're a hospital, you've got this humongo investment, you know, in the buildings and in staffing and in anticipation and of people coming through the door and things like that. So within the context of the system, when it comes to delivery, we have to, and just watch UnitedHealthcare and some of these big guys. They're not buying hospitals. Nobody's buying hospitals. They buy each other so they can get bigger and bigger and bigger, thinking that that's the way to overcome the problem that you're talking about. But what does it do? It just continues to raise. It continues to raise the price. So I'll just tell you my suggestion, which is that one of the original problems that occurred in Medicare and Medicaid was not Medicare and Medicaid. That was a great idea. It's having Blue Cross, which was owned by the hospitals, basically, and Blue Shield by the doctors, in charge of what it was going to cost. And a doctor that I still around in his 90s that I respect a lot came to me when I was a brand new little boy working for a new governor and said, you're going to find out that that's going to cost you a lot of money when this gets implemented. By 3 years later, in 1969, Richard Nixon had a press conference saying the cost of healthcare in this country is going through the roof. It's going to break us. By January of 1970, Fortune magazine had a 23-page front page story, bigger than this Taxifornia story that I was holding up here earlier, about how the costs are going to kill American business. Now, why do you all have to worry every year about insurance and about the alternatives to your insurance? Why? Why couldn't you buy, say, a 5-year membership in a Kaiser or some other kind of a health company? Maybe it's Sutter or maybe it's UCSF. Why not? Because nobody's thought of it, I guess. But why do we separate? The only reason we buy insurance is because that's the way it got set up to make sure that they got paid. All right, we pay directly with a membership in this company, this health company. I asked, with all due respect to George Halverson, who came from Minnesota, I asked him when he took over Kaiser here 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years ago, is it a hard job? He said, no, all I do is shadow price everybody else. Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah, guys. A great idea. A great idea. A health company called Kaiser Permanente. If they could offer you 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6-year memberships, their incentives are to keep you healthy. Their incentives are to see that you get the right diagnosis in the right place at the right time, and you're not discouraged by the price from going to the hospital or going to the emergency room or going to see the doctor in the clinic or whatever the case may be. That's the discouraging factor to too many people today. But a membership can be subsidized the same way anything. The insurance can be subsidized. Okay? Thank you.
Thanks so much for your talk today, and it's very good timing. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine recently. We're both politically pretty moderate. We consider ourselves sort of common sense moderates, and we both felt like we're people without a party because we just feel like if you try to have a rational discussion, it seems like with the internet, the extremes get the most clicks, and those are the things that come out, and that has become the debate. So just wondering, I've always been a fan of politics, but lately I find myself not wanting to get involved. I used to go to all the local meetings. I used to go to the debates for candidates and stuff like that. And I still do a couple, but I'm finding myself getting so turned off by the extreme nature. And like, that's why it's so refreshing to hear your talk, because there are, frankly, just not many people like you now. So what I'm just wondering if you have any advice for people who want to be involved today in politics but are feeling turned off by the extremism on both sides.
Thank you for the question, and thank you for being here tonight, everybody. I appreciate it a great deal. It's going to sound flip, but my first answer is everybody in the room went out and bought a book called When Republicans Were Progressive. We could start a new party called When Republicans Were Progressive Party. And we wouldn't, you wouldn't have that far to go. California could teach you something about it. Washington, Oregon, Colorado. You could take yourself through the country, and you could find a lot of people would sign up for this when Republicans were progressive, or when Democrats were really, I guess you can't do it with Democrats because they've now taken the word progressive for something that means something else. So that was sort of like the sounded flip, or the facetious answer to the. Answer to the question, but the real thing that you and I together have to do is this year is to make a decision about who the Democratic candidate's going to be. Serious. Mine is the Harold Stassen guy that I've already mentioned. Happens to be the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Why am I attracted to him? Because he reminds me of Harold Stassen. Not necessarily, but because he speaks a different language and he speaks in a different way about the things that I've cared about all my life. He doesn't have a this plan for that and a that plan for that. And I'm not trying to put those people down because this is what we need. We have somebody to speak about. Like the question about healthcare, what do you replace it with, and so forth. But he lives in a different world, so to speak, as do most people that age or younger, but not everyone. But he's one of the fortunate ones who's had an opportunity to serve at the local level. And when you do that in Indiana, for some reason or other, my favorite people are the mayors of Indianapolis who made Indianapolis a great city, mm-hmm. starting with Dick Lugar, who was, my classmate and going right through about five of these mayors. That's a whale of a job, and it's a very important job. And you noticed when he got called out for the shooting and so forth, how he reacted to that. There's going to be that kind of an opportunity for you now. And I have to recommend that for starters, because I had to make that own decision myself. While I wait to see what's the next one going to be, somebody would say, "Oh, how about John Kasich, or how about Jeb Bush, or how about people like that?" Of course, but this party, the current Republican Party, isn't going to go for those guys. So you go for somebody as close to them as you think. And I just like the idea the guy's only 37 or 38 years old. I do, honest to God. That's why I started with Harold Stassen saying he's only 30, or 31, or you got me to, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So what? It's who he is, and what's his purpose in life? How does he express the things that are important to him? So that's the way I'm doing it.
Thank you, sir, for a terrific presentation, and you did steal my thunder because it's a Pete Buttigieg question. Couldn't agree more with the gentleman over there. 26 candidates, and very tough for any one of them to say they're representing me as a moderate or independent. The closest being Pete Buttigieg. I was going to ask you, since you gave a positive analogy to Harold Stassen earlier on, you were referring, I think, positively to the mayor, what you think of his Supreme Court proposition of adding five new nonpartisan judges because the Supreme Court has seemingly become so activist. I'm not particularly in agreement. I look back to FDR, completely different proposal, but it's too bad that we've come to that. But do you have, am I missing something? Is there merit to it?
No, I hate to say after you compliment me for the comments, I hate to say you're all wet, but you know what I mean, that institution has survived a lot. I mean, all three of the institutions, presidency, the Congress, and the Supreme Court has survived a lot, you know, and there's been these ups and downs and so forth. It seems worse today because the consequence of a 5-4 decision is enormous when it's driven simply by the originalists, so to speak, on the Supreme Court. But I, in all of my experience, I just have to say that I'm not about to take on any one of those institutions, because it's us who have to change. It's communities that have to change. We have to build it from the ground up. We have to rebuild our parties and so forth over time, and it will. It will happen, because we are not a Roger Ailes America. No way. That isn't us. There might be some people that sound like it, and a lot of those people are in a position, you know, to get their people on the Supreme Court right now, the freedom, whatever it's called, or that particular bunch of lawyers. But that too shall pass.
That's an interesting, you mentioned Roger Ailes. He was your campaign chairman way before, and you mentioned in your book, yeah, you mentioned in your book how he was watching when right-wing radio got started, and that was before he started Fox. So he watched Limbo and these guys growing, and that you think maybe that had part of what he had to do. But anyway, you knew Roger Ailes well when he was a young man, apparently. So
yeah, Roger came to me to check me out. He didn't run the campaign, but he ran the PR for the campaign. And you know what he did for Nixon and all that sort of stuff. And he came to check me out to see whether I'd get elected. And at the close of the hour, he said, "Yeah, I'm going to take your campaign." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because I want to beat Bob Goodman's ass." I said, "Who's Bob Goodman?" He said, "He's got Rudy Boschwitz's campaign. He's my competitor." That's how Roger measured my value. But he showed up in the reelection, each of my reelection campaigns, but I kept control of the content of the message, and his view was simply, you know, if you don't listen or look at the polls and find out what's going to sell and put that up front, you aren't going to get reelected.
Yeah,
and I said, no, I put myself up front, you know, and then other people can deal with those other issues.
Last man that resisted him.
So kind of a follow-up to the last couple questions, but I think, you know, what we've witnessed in the last 15 or so years is the collapse of the center, first in the Republican Party and now possibly in the Democratic Party as well. So, you know, with all the forces that you described that have brought us to the current condition and all the money in the system, how do we rebuild the center with all the forces arrayed against that happening?
How do we rebuild the system in basically strengthening the power of the right, left, center, which we know still is there. Mm-hmm. They're still there. That center still exists. But they're given choices from the extremes. You know, they take the best they can out of those choices. But it is still there. It's still who we are, as whether it's California, Minnesota, even perhaps someplace in Alabama or someplace like that. It's still there because it's all in our genes and in our families and in important things like that. So I think that's the giving rewards at some level to the people that make the most sense in public policy is where you start. So I start at the local level. I start in every city You know, every school board, every city, every county, you know, and I worked my way up. So I spoke last week to the League of Minnesota Municipalities, and I said basically that. You people can't get anything. You people aren't partisan. You may belong to one party or the other, but when you go around the state meeting, if you're a Democrat and you go around the state and meet a Republican mayor, you all have the same problems, you know, and you all have the same solutions to those problems. So you start at that level all over this country, including in the state of California, and you work your way up to the state legislature from there, because it's not going to come top down. That the weight of money and influence and everything now is so heavy at that level, and it's soaking down to some degree into the states and things like that. But you got to build it from the bottom. You got to build this from the bottom up. It's no accident that a lot of people, good think tank people, I don't know if any of you have read the Deb and the Fallows, Jim Fallows and his wife. They spent 3 years going around the country to about 50 different cities in their Sirius airplane, which is made in Duluth, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. CIRRIUS, something like that. And just tapping into communities around the country just to see how people react and act and react. So I'm like 100% convinced going to have to be a bottom-up effort at some point, because at some point we can't allow the inevitability that the Electoral College is going to make presidential decisions is part of this. I've been there forever. It's like the Senate has two from every state. You know, that's there. So that's why I say we got to start from the bottom up, because we may have the majority of the votes nationwide, you know, because we have these big metropolitan centers. But they're not the wisest people in the world either. Look at San Francisco. No, anyway, that's the answer to a very good question.
I wanted to go back a little bit to history, and I was just wondering, when you were talking about Harold Stassen, if there was any comparison between him and Hubert Humphrey, who was this boy wonder mayor of Minneapolis, mm-hmm. who rose up in...
Yes, thank you. I talk about that on occasion, because her book is written in that same period of time in the 40s that Stassen was in his presidential decision-making mode and all that sort of thing. And so what we say, suppose 1946 came along, you know, the first vote after the war ended. And Stassen, there was a former Democrat who turned Republican in 1940 in the United States Senate, and he was up for re-election in 1946, and he could be easily beaten. So Stassen recruited Supreme Court Justice Luther Youngdahl to run against him. He recruited Ed Thye, the governor, to run against him, and then got Luther Youngdahl to run for governor. If Stassen had run for the Senate in 1946, he'd have been elected at least 2 years before Hubert Humphrey. And think of what that, with that man, with that those gifts and that talent would have meant as a basically a balance to a Hubert Humphrey. He would be with him on a number of issues, I'm sure, no doubt about it. But he would be a counterweight. He might have run in 1956 for president. He might have run in 1960 for president. I don't know. But if he had been in the United States Senate with a voice like he has and a belief system like he had, God only knows where we might have been today.
All right. There's only time for a couple more questions.
Mayor Pete is very interested in the 2-year civic service after high school. Also, Patrick Javal and I think General McChrystal have also gotten behind this. What do you feel about that? 2-year mandatory service in either the military or the civic.
What do I think of the idea for 2-year mandatory service? I think it was 1987, 88, something like that, when Teddy Kennedy, no, it was beyond that, it was in the 1990s. Kennedy was putting together the National Corporation on National Service. And he asked me if I would be the Republican sponsor, corporation, the corporation that AmeriCorps came out of and so forth. And he asked me if I'd be the Republican sponsor. I said, only if you add the word community to it. So it became the Corporation for National and Community Service. It's a source of great pride to me to have done that. But to your question, I will observe that I had to go to the floor one night while the bill was being considered and debate my Republican colleagues, because we shouldn't have to pay people to do things, you know, for free. Those volunteers should do things for free. We shouldn't have to pay them. And I said, wait a minute. You guys are all for some kind of voluntary service, like go in the Army, go in the Navy, you know, for a year or two just to get the experience of serving your country. I got a bill that you can serve the country, you serve the country, and you get paid only $5,000 a year, called the National Corporation for National and Community Service. Today, we still don't pay more than $1,200, $12,000 or something like that. I'm not sure exactly what it is. But yeah, I mean, whether it's 1 year or 2 years, I'm sold. I mean, I just think it's a great idea. The gentleman over here had a question.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so you're a big time politician, or you were senators like three times.
Yeah.
And then you've mentioned that to build sort of this middle ground, you have to sort of start at the grassroots, the local level, right? So different from where you came from.
Right.
I've always found that, like, what do you think there's room for people to talk about complex issues, like, say, immigration? There's many, many elements of it, instead of, like, saying you're either for or against it, right? But rather talk about the nuances of each and say, and basically speak in a way of, like, on the one hand, this person, this is a point of view. On this. And then on this other hand, here's another point of view, acknowledging both sides and then going across all the sub-issues associated with it. Or is that something like that's just way too complicated that gets crushed at the kind of the big-time politician level and only works lower level?
Right. Well, thank you for the question. My response to it is that we work at the little-time politician level. And the same response I made to the question behind you. I got a friend who lives up in Truckee, and in February he invited me to go down and watch. He used to play basketball for Washington, and they were playing Stanford, and he asked me if I want to go to the basketball game. So I said, sure. I went to watch the Pac-10 champion Washington Huskies beat Stanford by 1 point, as I recall. But then I went out to have a beer with one of his buddies, whose hashtag and his license plate is called Hookshooter 23. Now, he's about 77 years old. He was a hookshooter, obviously, in basketball, about 6'7" or something like that. And we got into discussion about education. And he said, I've been a principal all my life, and they still call me back to school. And I said, why do they call you back? And he says, because I have a different notion of what a school is. And then he began to explain to me how, almost from the get-go, but somewhere during his career in education, when he became principal of a school, he watched what happened when you hire a new teacher. They come into the school, they go find the grouchiest teacher to tell them what's wrong with the place, you know. It happens time after time after time, you know. So he said, stop. From now on, everybody in this place, from the janitors to the public safety people to the teachers to whatever, is going to be pledged before they come to work. They're going to got one purpose in being here. At about 8:15 every morning, it becomes their purpose and their privilege to help somebody they may never meet raise some little 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old kid. And he says it works. You'd be surprised. And he goes into it, he elaborates. How do we celebrate achievement? for a 5-year-old, for a 6-year-old, for a 7-year-old, for an 8-year-old. You use your imagination. You can see where you can go with this. So my point is, at the local level, whether it's school reform, or it's health reform, or it's the social determinants of health, which is becoming a big talking point right now for a whole lot of people. There are opportunities for each of us and our families to get more involved.
So how would you advise Mayor Pete though? Like, if you know, can he talk at that level? Can he talk at this, like, this way and that way and like a thoughtful way, or does he have to like stick to the sound bites and whoever's going to give him the money and whatever?
You mean in his candidacy?
Is it realistic to for him to sort of try to be the person you're describing at the local level?
I think if he told that little story that I told you, but he does it the way a 38-year-old, 37-year-old mayor, you know, with kids in school, whatever, or I don't know whether they're old enough to go to school. But if he told that story, if he had an example of it in Indiana, in South Bend, it would be even better. And he told that story, a lot of people would start scratching their heads saying, I didn't, never thought of it.
Why the heck can't any politician do that?
Well,
it's so obvious.
It's the media. Part of it is media. Part of it's media. And part of it is the person themselves. I mean, I think Mayor Pete could do it. He just haven't met this hook shooter 23.
I think it's also in the last 60 years that the game has changed. It always was like that, but I think the best incentive for any political system is to change the rules of the game so that different people want to play the game. And I think that this game is such a hard game to play that only people who are desperate for that attention, you know, come almost. Now, there's a couple outliers, you know, but it's the difference between playing hockey and playing golf, you know. And I think you have different people play the game. And I think that's one of the things that I think about the book that's really good is it gives the background, the local build-up that Harold Stassen sat behind, picking people, pushing people, moving forward, putting them in different roles that took place, that eventually had leaders all across the country doing things. So thank you very, very much, Senator, for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, but I have to tell you that I talked to John Rothman and the other day, and he said, please apologize, because he knew I was going to, you had asked me to talk about Stassen. He said, please apologize because I'm not there, but I'm on KGO, is that it right now? From 6 to 9 p.m., so I can't make it. But he's our local Harold Stassen lover.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right.
That's how I got the job.
Good.
So thanks again for everyone coming.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to the live audience.